This is Laura Cameron Fraser, Jung's Treatment of Christianity, October 26, 1985, tape 1 of 4.
And she has had, for many years, including her doctoral work, an interest in the work of Jung and the correlation and interaction between psychology and religion. It's my pleasure to introduce Laura Fraser.
Thank you, Anna. We've got my wired for sound over here, so how's my sound carrying? Are you able to hear me over there? Is there anybody who doesn't hear me all right? All right. I've been looking forward to being with you this morning and working with this subject. I do want to work with you and not just at you on it. And at some point, this may be the best point, I don't know, I'd like to ask you to write for me just one question that is on your mind about this area that you would like to see answered before we're through today. And would you like to do that to start with? Do all of you have paper? And could you just write one question for me? If you have two, of course, two burning questions, write those. But just to give me a sense of where you are, I would like to start. I think what I'd like to do today is concentrate this morning on four major aspects of Jung's critique of Christianity and what we make of that critique. And then this afternoon, I'd like to look at the question of what do we do with that? Where are we going with that? What is the church going to do with that critique, if anything? Or what can be done with it? What will likely be done with it? All of that. The first point that I would like to make is illustrated by a story that you all know very well, I'm sure. It's the story of Paul on his way to Damascus. And you recall that Paul was an extremely zealous persecutor of the first Christians. That they appeared to Paul to be an extremely serious menace to the law as he understood it. And he did understand the law very well. He was a scholar in that tradition. And there was a lot of anger in Paul about any kind of threat to the way his world was ordered. And that was the way his world was ordered, by the Hebraic law. So he became a very zealous defender of it and had sufficient contacts with the powers that be in that world that he was given a lot of authority, including the power of life and death, over Christian offenders. You may remember that he stood by while Stephen was stoned to death. A very poignant scene that in the New Testament, poignant for Paul as well as for others, because one can be certain that Paul was not a bad person, whatever that might mean. He was a person that was defending the only world that he knew, and defending it in the only way that he knew how. And he must have felt the poignancy of the death of Stephen in himself to a large extent. Here was a young man that came from the same kind of family that he did and represented real quality in Jewish life at that time. And he was being stoned to death. It has to have been a very painful scene, but Paul represents a very extreme position there. Then he is on the way to Damascus. It is his intent to continue what he is doing. He is going to Damascus to gather those who are violating the law and persecute and eradicate them. On his way, he is suddenly stopped in his tracks by what we would have to call a very highly numinous experience. And he experiences the divine in some form, and he just literally falls off his horse onto the ground, and he is involved in a dialogue with that numinous personality that speaks to him and which identifies himself as Jesus. And Paul is blinded by this experience. He emerges in a state of numbness, of unconsciousness, unconsciousness at least in relation to what his usual state of consciousness is, and he can't see. And he has to be led by the soldiers who are with him to Damascus, where he lies in a room there, just literally beside himself, outside of himself. This experience is an example of what Jung referred to as enantiodromia, where one extreme position will be compensated by another. The extremeness of Paul's position is compensated by an extreme experience of the opposite kind. Jung observed that this motion could be seen in an individual's life, but also in the larger society in which we live, that any unbalanced position will eventually pull up out of the unconscious the opposite pole. But he did not see history as a swinging between these extremes. That is a position that some have taken in history, that we have a kind of cyclic motion. But Jung did not see our development historically that way, at least not ideally so. I think that he saw that when things were working adversely, that they could work that way. But what he saw as a more ideal development was that this extreme position would call forth its compensation, and that then a position much more central and balanced could evolve out of those two extremes experiencing each other. I don't know whether we saw that happening in Paul or not, or whether he just simply reverted over to the other extreme. But Jung saw as a very desirable movement in history that one would, an individual or a group of individuals experiencing this swing would not necessarily lose what had been attained in this pole, and that they would, in their swing to the other, begin to experience what a middle position might be like and be able to return to that. Now, I mention that concept, which is possibly familiar to many of you, because it leads me into the first point that I want to make concerning Jung's critique of Christianity. Mithraism and Christianity arose at a time when there were extreme libidinal excesses, that when the life of the instincts and of the body was just completely out of hand. If you read material about the Rome of that time, you will see that it is one of extremely little discipline or control, and that man had very little defense against the forces of the unconscious pushing up through him, pressing for expression, and that he was, in a sense, very easily possessed by those, one at a time or all of them together or whatever, that his conscious side was not adequate to defend him against those pressures. So that Christianity and Mithraism arose as a compensation for that. Mithraism, or Mithraism. These two movements both concerned themselves with the necessity of the self to achieve control over the instincts and the passion, regardless of the sacrifice and suffering that that entailed for the ego and for the body, for whatever had to be sacrificed. In order to accomplish this control over the unconscious, let's just sum it all up by that expression right now, Christianity stressed a transcendent God, masculine in character, essentially spiritual and disembodied, in space and removed from man, not arising within man, but transcendent to and exterior to him. And man found his control over these inner pressures by an allegiance to that power, which was in a sense suspended in space and disregarding what was happening here. In a sense, sacrificing what was happening here, sacrificing the body, sacrificing instinct, sexuality, feeling, all of those things, if necessary, were sacrificed to the ideal of this disciplined control coming about through allegiance to a masculine God. Possibly you can see why the God had to be masculine. I don't want to spend a lot of time moving into that right now, but I will come back to it if you'd like to discuss it. Let me just make that point there now. But Christianity, which then became the prevailing carrier of this value, was successful in bringing about this kind of discipline and control. And it was extremely useful in the development of Western civilization in harnessing and channeling these energies to building Western civilization as we know it, which could not have been built on the kind of situation that we see in the pre-Christian Rome, for example, and Egypt. Now, Christianity was early signified by an interesting symbol. We recall that Jesus came to be represented as a fish. Christianity was seen as coming to birth under the sign of Pisces, but the sign that stood for Christianity was not a single fish, but two fishes. And they were going in opposite directions. One up, one down. And this is a very interesting symbol and has many aspects to it. But one of the things that we need to see about it certainly is that those two fishes swimming in opposite directions do represent contrary pressures or just opposites, if you will. Now, Christianity didn't do a very good job, it seems to me, of embodying symbolically those opposites, even if it was signified by those two opposites. It managed the conflict between those opposites by suppressing one and elevating the other. And that, of course, has been pretty costly. It perhaps was necessary at the time. It may have been the only way, in fact, that it could have been successful, because man at that time probably was not ready. He was so absolutely subject to these pressures of the unconscious that he probably was not ready to try to deal with the whole concept of enduring the anguish of contrary pressures or opposites within himself. But this was certainly one of the major reasons why Christianity came into existence, was as representing this necessary control and suppression at the time. Now, Tillich seemed to feel, Paul Tillich seemed to feel, that the person of Jesus Christ represented a full picture, an adequate picture of a whole God-man. Jung, as you know, I'm not going to spend a lot of time laboring this point because I think that most of you are quite familiar with it, but Jung was quite critical of the Christ figure as we inherited him as an image of wholeness. And so Tillich seemed to feel that Jesus could mediate to us an image of wholeness. Jung said no, that Christianity represented one extreme, and that the suppression that it involved called for a compensatory movement in turn, even as it was initially a compensatory movement. I want to deal at some length with this compensatory movement, which we see going on today. But right now, I want to just establish Jung's contention that Christianity was a necessary historical corrective, but that it is in turn in need of a new historical corrective, and that process he called an adiodrama. All right. Before I leave that point, let me make one further observation about it that I think might be very important. I'm thinking about a class that we have going on at St. Michael's right now, which is centering upon the life of Jesus and trying to look at the facts, what might have been the facts of Jesus' life, rather than the conventional Christ as the Church presented it. And therefore, in one sense, you might say that the position of conventional Christianity is sort of sitting in ruins in our class at the moment. Just got this array of fragments sitting around us, and the question is being raised, why do we need the Church? Is there any reason for the sacraments that the Church offers? It just would seem best to be dispensed with. I'd like to say what I think Jung's position about this is. He felt that it was extremely important in the successful resolution of the process of enantiodromia that you not simply abandon the previous gains, and that you hold fast to those, and that you work your way through them into the compensation that is needed. If you simply abandon where you've been, it does mean also abandoning the gains of that position. And therefore, you are at the mercy of this swing into the opposite and equally unbalanced extreme. And the only way to avoid that is to hang on to what you had and appreciate its value and hold to it, but see its insufficiency and move out of it from there. We see in our society at large today that large numbers of people have indeed done just that, that they have moved right out of the old value and are existing in a cultural and ethical vacuum, and that the consequences of that have been pretty costly. There are an awful lot of people in the young generation especially who simply have been wandering around in a void and paying a bill for this kind of chaotic movement out of what society had, but for them no longer has. So I'll just leave that there, and we will return to that. Now, the second major point I want to make of, I'm looking at Christianity through Jung's eyes. And that is, in Christianity, what Jung described as a systematic blindness. Now, I'd like to develop that a little bit. Christianity, in positing this God out here in space, transcendent, no connection with his creation, which is down here, and of the flesh, and inferior and sinful. In establishing that connection, it showed exactly zero respect for man's soul, which is in itself then not the source of its salvation, not to be consulted. Its help must come to it from outside. And it's in the position of a humble supplicant without interior resources. Of myself, I am nothing. And there's an extreme poverty there. The consequence of this is that Christianity became a very external religion. It was a very extroverted religion. Its power came to you from the outside. And to this day, those who are involved in converting you to the Christian faith will assure you that in yourself that you do not have the power to save yourself, and that there is nothing good in you, but that Jesus Christ can raise you up and give you a new life and make everything in you new, but it does not come from you and is not related to what is in you. And it will succeed in you only to the extent that you cooperate with it completely. Now, obviously, I'm drawing this situation to its extreme, and we can find aspects of Christianity that aren't quite this extreme, but nevertheless, I think this is the essential picture that Christianity has of itself, that God is outside of man, and that the soul, the unsaved soul, is a matter of contempt. The dogma or the understanding which Christianity has of itself is dogmatic intellectualism or rationalism. If you read contemporary theologians like Bultmann and Barth, you'll find very rational, very intellectual kinds of people. And Bultmann's idea was that the adaptation of Christianity to the modern era was to demythologize it. Now, of course, this man did not understand that to demythologize Christianity was to leave nothing there. Absolutely nothing there. I mean, the value in Christianity is its myth. And to demythologize it is to destroy it. And of course, we are observing its near destruction at the present time. You know, it is in many places quite dead at the moment. There is also in Christianity what we'll call a bureaucratic tidiness. And this is a kind of zeal for its self-preservation. And if you look at a lot of aspects of it, they are, in fact, done for the preservation of the institution. Institutional religion has to resort to many different things to preserve itself. And many of them are not in themselves edifying. There is also, in the modern era, in Christianity, that was not always so, but there certainly is so today, a sclerosis. And if you consider this analogy, that it is somewhat like the body, and a development of sclerosis is a kind of hardening and rigidifying, and eventually the health-giving flow of blood simply cannot reach the parts of the body. And this certainly has happened in Christianity. A kind of sclerotic condition exists in which the arteries and veins have hardened and rigidified, and the life-giving flow is not taking place. Jung used an expression with regard to it, which I think is quite wonderful: sacrosanct unintelligibility. And what he meant by this, I think you can see what he meant by this. But just to comment on it, the doctrine, when it becomes sacred and can't be touched and can't grow and is removed from life-giving blood, then it becomes unintelligible because it's not moving with living, moving human beings. There is no particular connection with the movements of their life. And in my observation of a church today, I can see, you know, I've observed the Christian mythos working out in the lives of several different communities of persons, and I can see that it's a fact that for the most part people simply are oblivious. I don't mean that they're ill-meaning or anything like that. They're simply oblivious of the implications of the mythos for their own lives. Simply doesn't touch at all, just pulls apart. And so there's some kind of sense of the proper, the appropriate that's being lived out there, but it's not connected to life for them. It's not life-giving. So the faith which originates with in a life-giving myth, and if it hadn't been a life-giving myth, it couldn't possibly have become what it was. But it became literalized and historicized. And in fact, modern theologians just love to say, well, the difference between Christianity and other religions is that Christianity is historical, you know, that these things really happened. And even back at its origin, you know, Peter said, now don't confuse Christianity with the other myths that you're hearing. You know, there may be similarities, but they're different. And Christianity is history and fact. Well, that position proved to be very costly for Christianity because the living qualities of myth were denied it. When people in my church hear me refer to the Christian myth, you can see the uneasiness. And yet, this is not a put-down. It's merely a statement that there's something organic and living there. Given the conditions that I have described, then, the practice of theology becomes an effort to give conscious validation to someone else's experience. And this is quite painful, to see ministers struggling to do this, innocent of their own experience, innocent of any validating roots in their own unconscious, going on someone else's word that it happened thus and so and that this is true. This leads to a very high rate of burnout because it can't be sustained. The life-giving roots have been disconnected there. And so you find ministers in droves leaving for other professions. But it also leads to a very low rate of convincingness. The minister cannot be convincing when he is speaking about something that he's been told and that he's carrying as something that he understands to be true, but doesn't know in his vitals to be true through his own observation and his own experience. All of this gives us very little basis for making a positive prediction about Christianity. You know, unless something changes quite radically. So that's the second major observation. You can see that I've made an attempt here to bring Jung's very extensive comments on Christianity into maybe four large generalizations. All right. Now, the third point that I want to make here is that naturally, when you have this kind of extreme position, there are counter tendencies and compensations that arise. And these arose in abundance in the early centuries of Christianity. There was just a plethora of heresies of one kind or another. Of course, they weren't heresies until they were declared to be so by the church. But the main categories of these were the early Gnostics. They were one group. And those who espoused the mystical tradition in one way or another. Hi, David. Later, the medieval alchemists and the Platonists of all stripes and descriptions, from Augustine to Kant. How unfortunately for Christianity, all of these movements, which was where much of the richness was, all of them were declared heretical and lopped out. So you've got then the development of a mainline tradition which is denuded of that which would have saved it, really, and made it whole. Now, of course, that's only partly true, because these movements have continued to reappear and reappear naturally. They had to do so in the church anyway, in spite of their heretical status. Thus, you can find in most periods of the church's history a flourishing mysticism somewhere, and some kind of variant of Gnosticism kept coming into existence again and again. And certainly today, in this century, we see an equivalent of the medieval alchemy coming to pass through the Jungian psychology. Alchemy is certainly here again. So these occur and reoccur. There certainly has been a strain of Platonism also from throughout history. Now, Jung pointed out that the individual, when he begins his process of individuation, has to go back and reincorporate all of the things that he sloughed off in the process of his becoming who he is, and in the process of growing up. You know, he keeps sloughing off this and sloughing off that and sloughing off the other, but then he has to go back and reclaim them as an adult and reincorporate them into his personality. So Jung's point is then that Christianity in its youth has sloughed off all these valuable things, that its mainline development might not be compromised. It is true, probably, that Christianity would not have survived unless it had been quite single-minded in a single line of development, because there was just so much going on that it could easily just have become like a field of mushrooms instead of one tree growing. So that sort of ruthless pruning may have been necessary for it. But in any case, it now has quite a task of reassimilation if it is to go on from here, of going back and picking up, allowing now those lopped off parts to be reassimilated. The fourth point, David, what we're doing is just kind of taking the major big points that Jung made in his critique against Christianity. We're just looking at the major thrust of those. And we've covered three of them, we're on the fourth. This one is a very important one, and Jung spent quite a lot of time with this. When Murray Stein was here, he talked about it too. It was for this reason that I wanted to be near the blackboard, because I'll be using it a little bit on this one. Jung's point here was that the Christian myth is dangerously incomplete as an expression of totality, and that the totality toward which humanity moves is not allowed by the imagery that Christianity lives by. And for this, he took the Trinity to task. Now, he was an admirer of the Trinity, because he said the Trinity is a kind of triadic movement that you see in many faiths. And it has a kind of interior validity to it. It's not just somebody's construct. Mardana, will be all right if I take this off. I think it'll still pick up, because I'm going to go over to the... I'll just put this here for a moment. the Christian Trinity. You have Father, you have Son, and you have Holy Spirit. And these are uncompromisingly masculine. In the Nicene Creed, which we say every Sunday in our liturgy in the church, the Holy Spirit is referred to as He. And so there's no question about the sexuality of the three persons in the Trinity. Now, Jung had a very interesting idea about this triad, and he saw it as it related to its universal pattern, that this was the source, and that this was the ego. Sometimes he referred to this as the word, and that this was the synthesis of these. And this he called the self, or spirit. And that this represented a kind of universal pattern. The third was a coming together of these two. So, this is the Son, the ego. The Father is the source. The Holy Spirit is this spirit, or self. And he felt that this pointed to the gradual transformation of the individual. That the individual comes forth from God, becomes a self, and gradually has to work on this connection, this relationship between itself and its source. And as it works that out to the point of transcending itself and its particularity, then it becomes the self, or at least the self begins to emerge into consciousness and gradually becomes more and more available until finally the self is incarnate in that person. And in that case, then, spirit is served. Spirit leads and guides that individual, even though he is a coming together of flesh and mind, feeling, and spirit. All of that. Okay, now, Jung was was quite supportive of the Trinity as an image of this, was quite impressed with it. And he saw the Mass, the Eucharist, as we call it, as a rite of individuation. He saw the Eucharist in a very deep light as a rite of transformation in which the individual would experience the emergence of itself from the source, the sacrifice of itself to the source for a higher good, the suffering that was entailed in that sacrifice, with which it could consciously relate, and thus the bread is broken and the blood is poured out, but then the bread is eaten and the blood is drunk and the individual becomes new, and thus the self is incorporated. You notice that word, made flesh, so to speak, incarnate. Now that's quite impressive, actually. And his understanding of the Mass is impressive in my mind. What inhibits the experience of the Eucharist that way, however, is the language that is used in the liturgy, which denies the universality of this process, denies the accessibility of it in the individual's psyche, and says it was an only son. In fact, the Father had only one son. And that son was the only good son, the only acceptable son. And he sacrificed himself to the Father for you, worthless ones. And thus, the Holy Spirit was liberated as a result of his sacrifice. Now, do you see the continual externalization of its own mysteries? Too bad, really too bad, because there's such a deep wealth of meaning here that is just virtually lost by that. And it's beautiful as you see it. Now, Jung felt that the Trinity was incomplete in three important ways. That it lacked the feminine, that it lacked the material, and that it lacked the demonic. Well, I think we need to examine that. As to whether that's true or not. Without doubt, it's true that it lacks the feminine. There's no question about that one. It's true also that it lacks the demonic, because the Son, the only Son, is described as being without blemish or sin. So, we can't find the demonic there. As for the material, not that the Church has done much with this. You know, I would have to agree with Jung that in essence he's correct, but of course the whole meaning of the Incarnation is that Christ did become flesh. But that part is not stressed. You know, the part that's stressed in Christian teaching is that he became flesh in order to suffer our condition with us and thus redeem it. Then he left it again, even though the myth says that he raised that body and then etherealized that body and made up with it. But still, there isn't much stress on the material there. That's what we've done with that. But there is the material present. I didn't mean a pun there. For the development of the material there. But I don't think Christianity's done anything with it. I mean, in short, it's got a mystery of incarnation, but it never really heard it or believed it or did anything. Devalued. All right. Now, I'd like to leave all that there, but I have to take it off in order to put on something else. So do you, is there any comment you want to make on that before I remove it? Well, it's a question of the flesh.
Oh.
The material aspect of existence.
Mundane.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Just the body. See, Christianity has tended to stress that if you're going to develop spiritually, that you've got to deny the body in some way and move beyond it.
kind of treated rather badly to teach at this place and learn to have complete mastery over it through the spirit. And the flesh was kind of a necessary evil, as it were. Not that Christianity is actually taught that, but that certainly is a continuing message, I think. Anyway. I mean, it's actually heretical to say that, but that's the message you get.
Would another manifestation of that be the idea, don't worry about your tribulations and troubles in this life, disavow the problems and feelings of grief that we have now.
Yes. Yes, that too. Okay, now, though we only said that those three aspects are missing in the Trinity, he proposed a quaternity as follows. Done quite a lot of thinking about this because he said that his thinking about this was that the sun constellated only the light aspects and that therefore required the postulation of a bad sun, which is quite right. And he did appear. He came, you know, into development historically only after Jesus appeared. There was a Satan prior to that. You can see mention of Satan in the Old Testament, but he didn't have the character of the devil at all. For example, when you see him in the book of Job, he's just a kind of lingo-like character, you know, that contends with God about Job's character, but he's not evil. Just sort of, he's like a contender against God, but not hostile to God in any way. So the devil does develop only after Christ appears as the spotless lamb. Then you get this dark figure of the devil, who throughout subsequent history was the only place that was really interesting in Christian lore. it's just quite interesting that this is the case. You know, the color is always over there. But there is Jung's quaternity. Now, let me talk about it a little bit. He felt that if you take this off, that there's no real way to solve the problem of incarnation. What will happen is that the devil is split off. He's out here. He's a God's enemy. There's no way to reconcile them. And therefore, you'll go into eternity with this split of the good son and the devil. And that all those that followed this one will go with him into eternity, and that there's no way to reconcile them. This was the absolute irreconcilability of good and evil. And so we pass over to the other side without resolving God's problem. And therefore it becomes eternalized. Well, that's not very satisfactory. it hasn't created a very satisfactory theology, not a very believable theology either, because some of us have a lot of trouble with the whole concept of an eternal damnation and a part of the creation cut off and permanently consigned to evil. So Jung said, okay, we'll remove it from there and put it here as a necessary counter then to this. And then both of these sons are gods. So they both come from him. And then they have to deal with each other. And eventually they have to embrace, which, you know, traditional Christianity would have a pretty difficult time with that. But that's what has to happen, so that there's a polarization, but then there is a reassimilation, and spirit becomes a reality because these can be reconciled into one reality. And man is stuck with this split and has to endure it. But at least it's not a permanently divided condition in Jung's concept. The polarization gives place to a new synthesis eventually, in which good has to understand its own relativity and has to accept the value that's carried by the other pole. How many of you have ever read Milton's Paradise Lost? So, yeah, you know, it's an extremely interesting work, psychologically speaking. And if you remember the picture of the devil, he is most interesting in Milton's Paradise Lost. In fact,
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.